Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
But there was nobody near the tower, there was nobody in the church. He went up on the roof, and then he started to hear two tolls of the church bell. He basically freaked out so much, he packed up his tools and left.
And he goes upstairs, and halfway up the stairs, he'd already seen there was a lady sat there. She's gone by the time he comes back down, and there's the chap that he met in the first place, and he said, "Right, I've done this, this, and this. Where's that lady now that was on the stairs? I just smiled and nodded to her on the way up. Is that your mother?" And he went, "Oh, her. Please don't pay any attention to her. Can we just forget that, please?" And he went, what do you mean? Is that not your mother?" And he went, "No, she haunts the place. Please, if you talk about her, she'll turn up more, and I really don't like it."
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
You are indeed. A fascinating show today on paranormal activity, ghosts and exorcism. I'll be introducing my guests Matt and Cal in just a moment's time. And thanks to everybody who came out for our live show on artificial intelligence and technology with John Wyatt this past week. It was really interesting, a lot of fun actually. If you weren't there, you can hear it next week on the show, including a little surprise we held on to for our live audience. Also, loads of great feedback to Tim Keller, the live show we aired last week. Quite a few outlets picking up on some of his comments on prayer and cancer over the past week too. Just a heads up as well, talking about live shows, our next one is on Tuesday the 7th of February. It's a hot button issue, sexuality, gender and identity. Two same-sex attracted Christians with different perspectives are joining me, Andrew Bunt of Living Out and the author of Finding Your Best Identity, opposite Charlie Bell, author of Queer Holiness. So you can be with us by registering at unbelievable.live. We'll take your questions to them both as well. For that live show, that's unbelievable.live to register. Links also with today's show, including to our website, where you can find all of our latest podcasts, articles and resources, and we'll hear some of your feedback later on in the show too. But for everything you need, premierunbelievable.com is your one-stop shop. For now, let's leap into today's spooky show. Well, today we're talking about paranormal hauntings and exorcism as a Christian and skeptic join me to discuss this. Matt Arnold is a Christian minister and editor of the Christian Parapsychologist Journal. He researches things that go bump in the night, accounts of the paranormal, exorcism and the continuing public interest in shows about hauntings and ghosts. Dr. Callum Cooper is a psychologist, author and science promoter who teaches at the University of Northampton. In 2018, he was recognised for excellence in sceptical activism and shortlisted for the Occam's Razor Award for his work. As it happens, today's show is going to land on video and podcast on Friday the 13th, which is an appropriate date to be talking about these sorts of issues. But how do a sceptic and Christian reconcile paranormal phenomena with their different worldviews? So we're going to find that out today with my guests, Matt and Cal. Firstly, let's hear from you, Matt. You were the one who really sort of suggested this. You've been listening to the show for a little while, and I was fascinated to find out you edit something called the Christian Parapsychologist Journal. Do you want to explain what that is and what it involves?
So the Christian Parapsychologist Journal is a journal that's been around nearly 50 years. It was first published in 1975. It's a product of the Church's Fellowship for Psychical and Spiritual Studies, which itself is 70 years old this year. It has patrons such as Dr. Rupert Sheldrake and Professor Rowan Williams, and it basically tries to look at parapsychology with a biblical lens. So taking and looking at some of the data that's being produced and saying, well, we can't just ignore this data. So what do we do with it? How do we work with it in a Christian sense?
Yeah, I mean, parapsychologists, some people might, their brains might go to sort of, I don't know, spiritualism and those kinds of connections. What specifically, what phenomena is it actually covering?
It will cover all parapsychological interests, so things like psi. It will look at the biblical approach to all sorts of things, because the Bible itself is filled with paranormal instances. So we have to kind of say, well, what was going on back then? And how do we view that same sort of thing today? For instance, near-death experiences, what's going on? We look at the data and we say, how does this fit with the Christian perspective on things?
So what got you interested in the first place in this sort of area, Matt? Have you always been interested in, you know, ghosts and exorcisms and, you know, horror films and that sort of thing?
I think, like a lot of my generation who were into this sort of thing, we grew up with a book that started it off called The Usborne World of the Strange, which talked about ghosts and that particular one. And I did a project at school on ghosts using that book and found that it was, wow, there's some really interesting stories that are going on here. I wouldn't say I was necessarily a Christian at the time, but I found it fascinating, the idea of something more than just the physical. And since then, I've just been interested in stories, accounts from people. And in my ministry, I found that people have been very open to talk about their experiences. And they find it very strange that Christians actually will listen to them, because they always seem to start off the conversation, you're going to think I'm crazy, but... And I go, well, no, I don't think you're crazy. Tell your story and let's see what comes from it.
Yeah. And I suppose in a way, in a funny way, people may not have a very developed idea of God or, you know, Christian doctrine, but they might have real opinions on whether ghosts exist or if they experienced some strange encounter or had some kind of paranormal experience. I guess that's what you encounter when you engage people, Matt.
Definitely. There is a real interest in the paranormal in society. And it's been going on for thousands of years, really. Some of the first ghost stories come from Mesopotamia. And we've got ghost stories in the Bible. And, you know, we've got ghost stories right the way through the Middle Ages. And, you know, it's big business now. Even the BBC have got podcasts dedicated to people's experiences of, well, I know what I saw, but I can't explain it with a scientific, with a currently understood scientific perspective.
I we'll talk about why this sort of area is so enduringly popular and of interest in the general public's consciousness. Cal, tell us a bit about your background. Did you have similar background in terms of your interest in these kinds of areas?
Yeah, I can relate to the Usborne book. There was a section of the library growing up where probably five or six books were all Fortean phenomena. So looking at everything unusual that's outside of parapsychology as well. So parapsychology will cover human experiences and abilities, such as telepathy, precognition, clairvoyance, psychokinesis, and anything that suggests survival of the mind out of the body or beyond its demise. Or things like the Loch Ness Monster and Bigfoot and UFOs, that goes into Fortean phenomena. And it's had a crossover with psychical research. One of my favourite cases investigated by Harry Price, the famous ghost hunter of the 1920s, 30s and 40s, was Jeff the Talking Mongoose on the Isle of Man, who had psychic abilities at the same time as being this hybrid mongoose that could talk to people and interact and had baby front hands. A very unusual case. So as a kid, that really interested me. I was getting into performing arts, though. That was the area I wanted to go into, but I took on later on psychology as a subject area to fall back on and use if, you know, getting into stage and theatre was never going to work out for me. But I got so interested in studying parapsychology through the lens of psychology that I stuck with it, and here I am today.
There you go. Tell us about sort of what direction then your views on parapsychology went in, because obviously from what I can tell from your biography and your website, you're essentially, in quote unquote, a skeptic when it comes to these things. Now, that could mean different things to different people, but what does it mean? How do you generally approach this whole area and phenomena?
I'm glad you asked that, because I think there's a lot of confusion amongst the public as to what skeptic means, and there is only one definition of what it means. Anyone acting outside of that isn't using skepticism and is not a skeptic. So skepticism should be some healthy critical thinking, rational inquiry, going through what we know of human understanding and processes of science and what fits the bill. And that's why they've got the Occam's Razor Award named after that particular award for, you know, skeptical activism and things related to that within the Skeptic magazine and Question, Explore, Discover conference. Occam's Razor is about, if you have an instance where you're facing something you don't quite understand, then take that fine razor and start shaving off the layers of how many steps in an explanation you need to take to find an answer. If you're shaving off too many layers, it's probably starting to become too far-fetched and away from the original thing. So if you can just shave one tiny layer to look to the next explanation, it's probably that, the least amount of layers you have to go through. And parapsychology is trying to look at that with some instances. We've got loads of reports of ghosts or people thinking they're having telepathic experiences, when actually, if you want to look at that singular case, you could start weighing things up and find there's a perfectly conventional explanation for why it happened, but it appeared to the person that experienced it like it's fantastical, like it's an exceptional experience, when actually it's not. However, we've got many cases on record that don't seem to fit those instances where we can't find a conventional explanation. And that's what's built up a massive collection of spiritual and psychical research over the years. I mean, you wouldn't believe how big the archives are for this area. So we've understood a lot of what's called the anomalistic psychology, processes we understand that appear paranormal when they're not. And then parapsychology still keeps going because we appreciate all of what's understood. But we also appreciate there seems to be something going on that's still just not quite understood, because we're dealing with human consciousness. It's so vast a topic.
Well, I'm fascinated to dig into maybe some specific cases. It's always interesting, I think, to look at some specific unusual phenomena, and we'll try and do that in the course of today's show. I mean, just coming back to that question of why this stuff still seems to engage the public imagination so much. You mentioned, Matt, the BBC have recently released some podcasts in the whole area of ghosts and hunt. There's been all those kinds of, you know, ghost sort of documentaries on the TV, the Blair Witch Projects and things like that, you know, films that still trade in this stuff. What's going on there? Why are people so constantly interested in this whole area, Matt?
Well, I think, as Charles Dickens said, ghosts are always news. People are really interested in, is there more to life than just this mundane physical realm? As I say, from ancient times, with people like Irving Finkel, who's just released a book on the first ghosts, right the way through to the Romano-Greco ghosts, people have always been interested in, I think also they've been having experiences of this thing, these apparitions, sensing presences, and we've wanted an explanation for it. And I think from a Christian perspective as well, the afterlife before the resurrection is something that really is fascinating to explore from a biblical perspective as well. And I think those that sort of say, oh, well, we don't need to do too much with it, we just focus on the resurrection, I think they're missing out a big chunk of what's going on with the experiences that everyday people are having. But also, you've got a kind of a bubble effect happening in terms of things like Netflix and Amazon Prime and YouTube, where what you see then becomes recommended further watching. So you're getting this reinforcing going on, and that's having an effect as well on the interest in the paranormal. And you know, you've got things like Ghostwatch, which is the very famous BBC case in 1992, where they played effectively what was a War of the Worlds style trick. Although it wasn't a trick, it was labelled as just a drama. But people found it fascinating and were gripped by it. And since we got into the 2000s with programmes like Most Haunted and then America Ghost Adventures, people running around screaming with green screen cameras and that sort of thing, people are people want to have an experience of something that they can't explain, because it's a great story down the pub, for one thing.
that's true. Okay, well, look, perhaps as we go through some cases that you might want to share, you might want to also comment on how this is adequately researched or not, as we go along. I don't know, Cal, if you want to sort of share any particularly interesting cases that you've come across. I guess a lot of cases with a little bit of, you know, research and investigation, you can find a, as you say, conventional explanation. What are some of the ones that leap to mind where it's harder to reach a natural explanation?
Unusually, the further back in time that you go with psychical research, the more thorough the investigations were. That's not to say that they're not today, but that they just would go to the nth degree with certain things. They'd be traipsing around graveyards looking for tombstones and names and dates and going through burial records and all sorts. So sometimes a single case study could be pages and pages of the SPR proceedings in early times. There was a famous case that I liked for a while, and recently Robert Sharman had dug it up again and given another critical review, especially on the handwriting that was involved. But it was called the Chaffin Will case, and it regards five brothers whose father had left his entire estate to, I think, the second youngest brother after he died. And it was several years later, one of the other, who was particularly ill as well, this brother was ill and the father knew it and thought, well, when he can enjoy my entire inheritance and then after he dies, it'll probably go to his four brothers. Unusual choice, but that's what he did. And then it was a few years later, one of the other brothers had a distinct dream about their father coming to him and saying, look, I wrote a second will and it distributes the entirety of my estate to all of you, all five of you. I changed my mind. And this is where it is. It's in my old jacket, sewn into the lining. And so he awoke from his dream. He knew that his mother would have the jacket. So, and this is in the late 1800s, contacted her, had to travel some 20, 30 miles or so, which was a big feat then to go and do that. They found the jacket. It was up in an attic space and had a bee's nest in it. It had been there for that long. And so they got the bee's nest off of it and looked inside. And lo and behold, something was sewn into the lining. But it wasn't a second will. It was a note that said, look in my daddy's old Bible, turn to Genesis. And it was so therefore the grandfather of these five brothers, and they go searching around for the Bible and they find it and they look in Genesis, and lo and behold, an envelope is in there that contains a second will signing everything to the five brothers and signed off by seemingly their father. Now that was considered a fantastic case for many years, because the lengths everyone had to go to uncover this information, how long that second will had been there for, the fact that no singular person gained, all five people were gaining out of this. So if it was set up, it was for fair gain rather than any one particular individual profiting from it. And then Robert Sharman looking at it more recently, because we do have the handwriting of Chaffin, the second will, the handwriting by handwriting expert's opinion, is that of someone younger, suggesting that, well, actually, your handwriting changes and it's very distinct, that it's becoming a more elderly person as you age. But the second signature, which should have been after the first, suggests it actually came before the first signature, which adds an air of scepticism to the whole case and who actually maybe made that second will. But there's other cases as well. I remember one that I wrote in a textbook called Continuing Bonds, edited by Dennis Klass and Edith Stepham. And I wrote about, well, what's the actual evidence for survival of death within these experiences around bereavement? And another late 1800s one, or early 1900s, submitted to the SPR, was of a travelling salesman whose sister had died, and he was in a hotel somewhere, writing up his accounts for the day, smoking a cigar, and he sat right next to the window in this hotel, overlooking some beautiful view. And he said, it was so distinct in that moment, I could see the embers on the end of my cigar, I could see the ink was still wet on my pen and on the page, and I knew someone was behind me. And so I turned in my chair at the desk and saw that no more than 3 or 4 feet away, sat on the edge of the bed, was my deceased sister. And I could see every blemish on her skin. I could see as though, you know, she was perspirating, there was sweat beads on her forehead. But she was staring at me, and then she disappeared. But one thing that he said that he noticed very distinctly was, in all this absolute detail, as though she was there, just as though you and I are here right now, I can see the features of you both perfectly, she had a scratch on her cheek that didn't make any sense to him whatsoever, a very distinct red scratch on her cheek. He goes home And he tells his family. His father mocks the whole thing. You must have been dreaming. And yet he got this clarification of the embers on the cigar. He's writing at the moment. He's very much awake and conscious. And he describes his sister, mentions the red mark, and his mother stands up in horror and lets out a shriek. And she said, I was trying to do a kind thing. And he said, what on earth are you talking about? And she explains that as the sister, her daughter, was laid to rest and maybe in the chapel of rest, she'd gone in to apply some makeup to her. And in doing so, one of the implements that she had to do so, she accidentally, you know, moved it in a certain way. She scratched the cheek of her daughter with it and then tried to cover it up with makeup, thinking, well, the lid's going to go on now, the coffin, no one will ever know. But through the apparition, this scratch mark was seen by her brother. And those are very interesting instances.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, these all make a great basis for some kind of short story or, you know, film of themselves, don't they? But... Okay, I mean, Matt, I don't know if you want to share a couple more examples or whether you want to comment on the ones that Cal has shared there himself.
No, I mean, I find those types of things fascinating, and it's the things that are difficult to explain that I find even more convincing, that there is something other going on with more than just the physical realm that we exist in. I mean, one of my stories that I first came across was a place in at Langenhoe in Essex. It was a church that's no longer there. It got demolished in the early 60s, 62, I think. And it was it's in a tiny little village near Colchester called Langenhoe. And it suffered some structural damage in 1884. And it was used up until 1959 when it became redundant. But a guy that came along... as the vicar in 1937 was the Reverend Merriweather, and he hadn't heard anything about Langenhoe apart from just being, you know, you're going to be posted there sort of thing. And when he arrived, one of the very first things that happened to him as he went in, the door behind him made the most almighty crashing sound, and he was, you know, more forcefully than he could actually reproduce by just slamming it as hard as he could himself. And he said that there was no wind around or anything like that. And then there was the curious incident in that place where when he was celebrating the Eucharist, they came to a point where there was the prayers for the church militant. And at that point, for quite a few instances in a row, you would get what sounded like clods of earth being thrown against the vestry door. And to the point where when they went outside, there was nobody there. So as this kept on happening at the same point in the Eucharist, what they then said is, well, let's station somebody outside to just keep an eye on what's going on. And they couldn't find them either. He'd be carrying out services and notice people at the back walk through the walls. He noticed afterward, or they found out afterwards, that there used to be a doorway where they were appearing from and heading towards. He said that there would be what's called phantosmia, which is ghostly smells, things like violets at the time of September when it wasn't the time for violets. This kind of strangeness was corroborated by a roofer they commissioned to do some work on the roof, and he couldn't get in. He had the key, couldn't get quite inside, and eventually managed to get through the door. But he said he felt like somebody was pushing against it on the other side. And the only time that actually he managed to get entry when he'd gone to the vicar, got back, and the door sort of was able to freely open at that point. But he said, well, it did feel like somebody was pushing from behind. But there was nobody near the tower, there was nobody in the church. He went up on the roof, and then he started to hear two tolls of the church bell. Now, he knows that he's locked the door behind him. There's nobody that he knows in the building. And rather than it just be, say, a bird flying into it or a couple of birds that just bang, like sometimes they do with glass windows, he basically freaked out so much he packed up his tools and left. but two girls later on were near the church at night, and they also heard... They'd heard that this place was a bit haunted, so they went along to see, you know, if they could see anything, as people do. And they saw an image of a lady moving through the churchyard and enter through where the north door used to be. So they got hearing, they got seeing, They got the bells. They heard the bells ringing twice again, which is strange. And there's lots of numerous instances of multiple witnesses with smells of rotting flesh that sent the people out of the church that would instantly be suddenly become the scent of violets again. You get those knockings at specific times when the church was talking about the living and those who had passed over. You get that knocking sound. All sorts of things like locked pubs opening. The interesting thing that started it off for him was when he couldn't get his case open into the church or into vestry, he could only open it outside the premises, outside the boundary of the church in the lane. And he took it in and he couldn't get it unlocked. And when he took it outside the boundary, he could unlock it again. So these sort of strange things were only settled when they actually said, right, okay, we think that there is something unquiet. There is someone unquiet or some people unquiet here. And they held a Requiem Eucharist for them. And then, rather than just going, exercise everything, they just said, right, let's have a blessing. Let's, you know, hold a Eucharist for these souls of the dead. And everything stopped after that.
Let me add a more modern one that has just sprung to mind because I've just seen Dr. Alan Gould and had a chat with him. But I was at his house having tea one time, and he said, oh, we had an insurance guy around recently because we got a burst pipe upstairs, and he was just surveying the damage and looking at the carpet, and he noticed all my bookcases. So when he was just giving me a summary at the end, he said, oh, I've seen you've got books on ghosts and things like that. Are you interested in that then? And he said, in a way, yeah, which is a massive understatement for Alan. Yes, you know, he led parapsychology at the University of Nottingham, was SPR president for a long while. And he said, so why ask? And he said, well, I was doing another insurance check at another house not so long ago, and it was a big house. It had got a staircase that wasn't straight up. You had to go up and then turn right or whatever, and then up again, big enough to maybe have a chair at that turning on the staircase or whatever, or some people might have a big vase, but there was a chair. And he's just told to go off and sort again this insurance check, go and look at the walls or whatever. And he goes upstairs, and halfway up the stairs, he'd already seen there was a lady sat there. And just nodded to her, and she smiled and nodded back, and he goes up the stairs, does his check. She's gone by the time he comes back down. And there's the chap that he met in the first place, and he said, right, I've done this, this, and this. Where's that lady now that was on the stairs? I just smiled and nodded to her on the way up. Is that your mother? And he went, oh, her. Please don't pay any attention to her. Can we just forget that, please? And he went, what do you mean? Is that not your mother? And he went, no, she haunts the place. Please, if you talk about her, she'll turn up more, and I really don't like it. Can you just stick to what you're doing, please? And the guy was just dumbfounded in the fact that this guy was fully aware that this apparition appears from time to time, but could you please move on, please? I don't want to discuss it. Which, gosh. I've heard of instances like that before where people have become so blasé about a repeated apparitional occurrence, someone else goes in unaware of it, they encounter it, and someone else just goes, oh yeah, blah blah blah, can we move on, please? And so unusual, because what do you do? Yeah. What do you do?
Absolutely. Well, look, we're going to go to our first break, and we've heard some fascinating little anecdotes and stories, but what I want to unpack is, A, Cal, what do you do with those, you know, as someone who is looking for arguably looking for a naturalistic explanation. So we'll come back to you on that. And Matt, how these, you know, whether you think a lot of these can be put down to naturalistic explanations, or whether actually this makes sense from a biblical worldview, because that's where we're going to go next in the conversation. So we're talking about paranormal hauntings. I'm sure we'll come to this issue of exorcism. Interesting to hear what Matt said there about the communion, you know, the rite of Eucharist that helped to clear that presence in that church and so on. We see what Cal makes of that as well. So, yeah, come back for more on this in just a moment. We're talking about things that go bump in the night, ghosts, paranormal hauntings here on Unbelievable today.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
My guests today on Unbelievable are Matt Arnold, who is editor of the Christian Parapsychologist Journal, and Dr. Callum Cooper, or Cal, as he goes with normally, a psychologist, author, and science promoter who teaches at the University of Northampton, but has a deep interest in these kinds of paranormal issues that we're talking about today. So, you know, we've just heard a lot of stories there, all kinds, you know, all very interesting. I can imagine a lot of the skeptics who listen to this show, though, Cal, immediately saying, well, come on. I mean, tales get changed in the telling over time. You know, that chap with his thing sewn into the jacket, you know, who knows how many, you know, hands that went through before, you know, and equally, you know, people kind of, if they hear somewhere it's haunted, you know, a church that's weird things happen, then everyone suddenly has a story about it or whatever. What was your approach, Cal, to this? I mean, do you sort of immediately say, no, there must be a natural explanation for these phenomena, or are you willing to sort of entertain the idea that there might be something beyond that going on?
I think we have to go back to the definition of skepticism again, and it's this critical thinking through whatever you're dealing with. So we've just discussed some really interesting cases. I'd be very surprised if Matt didn't identify as a skeptic of his own field as well. Anyone giving any serious thought to the studies that they're doing doesn't take what they're facing with the topic, its history, the methods, as read. If someone just gave it to them, you'd have a read and a serious think through what you're reading, and you would highlight questions you may have about things, and that's the important thing. It's weird when you get people that just describe themselves as, well, I'm a skeptic or skeptical activist. I'm a skeptical activist within psychology. But when people talk about it generally, I don't know what that means, a skeptic of everything. It makes no sense. But you've got skeptic movement groups, which I find bizarre, but they could be dealing with some niche topics like climate change and homeopathy and things like that, and of which there's some very interesting talks that come about this, where they're looking at all the for and against. But I don't think there's a broad definition of skepticism. It just is rational inquiry, critical inquiry within your own field. And so with these cases, I like Tony Cornell's approach. Tony Cornell wrote a brilliant book with Ellen Gould called Poltergeist and another one called Investigating the Paranormal. And he said, if you go into any case believing that all sorts is going on, then you'll see all sorts is going on. If you go in thinking it's a load of nonsense, then you'll come away thinking it's a load of nonsense. My approach is, if someone makes a claim and they seem very, very honest and sincere, then the thing that I hang on to is, okay, whatever has happened, you seem very honest and sincere. I don't think necessarily the phenomena is honest and sincere. That's a different thing. But what you saw and experienced, you found it serious enough to want to talk to me about it and want me to look into it. So let's go in. And I am going in with a critical thinking hat on. I'm looking for everything around the environment like a medic in a battlefield, searching for everything that's going on and what to deal with or check out first. But still, I'm going in with that razor blade and taking off fine layers of, let me look at this. Okay, no, maybe not. Let me look at this. Okay, maybe not. What if we just sit here for a while and just chat and see if anything happens while we get lost in conversation? Like would happen in a haunted house, it happens when you least expect it. You've got to be living in the building. You're not sat staring down a corridor. You're not sat in the basement all night eating your sandwiches and drinking coffee waiting for that ghost to turn up. It doesn't work like that. It doesn't work like in the TV depictions. You're not running about with night vision cameras. That's not how we investigate. We live with the building. We document. We observe. So that's how I would approach
it. Okay. Let's apply Occam's razor then to one of those cases we've discussed. Let's take the woman who appeared to, I think it was the brother, and seemed, you know, to be so perfectly represented, but with this scar across her cheek. And then when he mentions it to his parents, his mother comes out with this statement. Oh, yes, I had scratched her accidentally before she went in the coffin. What would you do to kind of try to get to the bottom of that one, Cal?
Well, first of all, we can't because it's so old and the case is gone and no one is alive anymore from that case to follow the inquiry. But you could draw a map of all kinds of possibilities, from conventional to getting into a psi theory. So we know Matt mentioned psi earlier, and psi is used to encapsulate, well, it could be clairvoyance, it could be telepathy, it could be precognition. We don't know. It seems to have a psychic element to it, but via which route it's operating, we're not sure, but it seems to be suggesting psi is going on. So he knows his sister's dead, and it's fairly recent. So he's lost in thought, he's doing the accounts, he's probably reflecting, and she's on his mind in some way. And maybe that has something to do with seeing what he believes is a vision of her. Even though he recounts that it's very, very clear and distinct, like you or I, but it's hard to actually go beyond that because he's the only witness to it. We do get apparitions where there are multiple witnesses, but it's just his word. Did he ever catch his mother mentioning the whole scratch? in earshot, maybe off in a different room, and it's just unconsciously gone in and it's been part of his apparitional experience. She swears that was the first time she'd ever mentioned it. She thought she got away with it and no one would ever know, and she was very distraught. So that seems to be legit. She seems quite convinced that she was keeping it a secret and she would never have discussed that with anyone. So maybe that's not a possibility, but we've got an element of, you know, information slipped in, we'd call it sensory leakage, and a bit of coincidence going on. So it's a line of possibility, even though some people are saying, no, I didn't know, I never would. Another line of inquiry, if we just jump straight ahead to the other side of things, we could start to tease the idea of maybe telepathy, so between living individuals, before we even entertain anything survive after death. We might entertain the idea that it just doesn't. Once you're dead, that's it, gone. So maybe telepathy is responsible. His mother knew, but hadn't told anyone. He is her son. They are very close. They're biologically linked. They are the most likely candidates to have a telepathic experience because close social group. And so she might have been thinking about, oh, I did this and no one will ever know, and the funeral's coming up, or it's just gone and she's down there, or she's just about to go through and she's got this on her cheek. I hope no one will ever see. And that worry of the mother goes to him while he's sort of in an altered state, lost in his ledgers, going through them, and sees an apparition of the sister, but generated by the mother, all telepathic. And that's what the early founders of the SPR thought a lot of apparitional experiences were, is a telepathic exchange. You're projecting the apparition. Nothing survives death. If there was a way of ruling out that it is not a telepathic exchange, then you're on to even further down the line, and you're looking at, well, she's come forward beyond death as an apparition to prove she survived, and her signal for that was this extra mark that someone else can verify for you. So you're going from one end of the spectrum all the way to the other. I'd certainly stick with this end, where we were talking about coincidence and hearing things in earshot and stuff. But we can't rule it out because it's been and gone. So we can look at this nice spectrum.
Yeah. Do you take a similar approach, Matt? I don't know kind of how much Occam's razor you apply to the cases you're looking in.
I go along a very, very similar thing. The Sherlockian approach. You eliminate all of the possibilities until whatever remains, however impossible, is the possible answer for it. So yes, I mean, you can't take everything that anybody says and say, oh, I definitely think that was 100%. You've got all sorts of things going on, from the psychology of a person, the circumstances of the situation, social things, mental health. You've got the environmental conditions of what's going on in a house. So you have to kind of eliminate as much as possible. But as Cal says, you have to listen to them, and you have to have that pastoral element that says, I believe that you believe you saw something, and deal with it from that perspective. It's interesting with the thing about the scar and being a signifier, because that does seem to be what comes through in Saul and the Medium of Endor, where Saul sort of can't see what's going on with the apparition of Samuel. The medium can see, but Saul can't. And she describes Samuel and says, oh, it's his robe. And, well, loads of people wore robes back in those days. But Saul suddenly falls down and does obeisance. And I puzzled on that, and then suddenly when I've realised, a couple of chapters before, Samuel and Saul, their very last thing that they actually had to do with each other was when Saul took hold of Samuel's cloak and ripped it. And so maybe within the text itself, even though it's not written down, maybe there was something there where she's explained, oh, I see a man, he's wearing a robe, it's ripped. And that's what triggered Saul to say, actually, yeah, maybe this is Samuel.
I mean, it's interesting you raise that particular example, Matt, from the Old Testament, because when I've sometimes heard Christians talk about that example, it's in the context of Christians being very wary of spiritualists and mediums and things like that. And I've heard people say, well, evidently that was, it's explained as being this apparition of Samuel, but in fact it's a demonic sort of appearance, because anything that is some kind of apparition or cognition or something to do with mediums and that sort of thing must kind of come from the dark side in some people's theology. What's your view on that? You know, where do you place that kind of phenomena in the kind of Christian biblical worldview?
I think that's called special pleading. where you've got apparition of Moses in the transfiguration of Jesus. Moses is dead. He's been dead well over 1,000 years. And so, okay, you've got the apparition of somebody else who's been in the afterlife appearing, and it's appearing to multiple witnesses that it's recorded anyway. So I would say the text itself specifically says that it was Samuel. So we have to ask, is the writer of the text incorrectly saying that this is Samuel? And when you get to the Septuagint, you get to 1 Chronicles 10, verses 13 and 14, and the translators, the Septuagint translators, specifically say that it is Samuel that arose from the from Sheol. So unless you want to start saying, well, I'm going to perform eisegesis on everything, I'm going to read into the text and tell the text what it should be saying, rather than let the text tell me what it should be saying, I would defer and say, I'm going to let the text tell me what it says at this point. And I believe that it was Samuel that was raised from the dead. The Mesopotamian literature speaks of the ability to raise spirits from the dead. And I don't think that God would deceive the writers of the scriptural text and say, you know, I'm going to let you think that it's Samuel, but actually it was a demon. So, you know, what do we trust at the end of the day? Do we trust our own interpretation that we don't want it to be Samuel that was raised because we have a preconceived idea that the afterlife is something that we'd need to change our understanding of if we accept that Samuel rose from the dead, or rose from the Sheol, or do we actually say, maybe I've got my understanding of the afterlife wrong?
Come back to you, Cal, for some commentary on this. I'd be also just interested in maybe your commentary on Matt's story of the ghostly hauntings in the church, and what they did that seemed to stop that activity happening. What's your view on sort of when religious rites do seem to have an effect on these kinds of activity and so on?
It starts to make me think a bit more about another branch of parapsychology that we have. So there are technically three approaches. One is anomalistic psychology, which I mentioned, exploration of psychology mainly and why beliefs lead to experiences, or conventional happenings lead to people thinking they're having experiences. Parapsychology taking that on board, but still looking at sifting the wheat from the chaff and what's left, and can we test it, can we challenge it? And then with this, there's clinical parapsychology as well. Which has a nice overlap to not only dealing with the parapsychological phenomena, but transpersonal psychology, religious and peak phenomena, looking at meditation, religious type experiences. And within that, we're not so much challenging the experience. In fact, we don't challenge the experience at all. We're looking at, okay, again, you've had an experience. We'll take that as read. Tell me about it. Why do you think you had it? And what's it done for you? Now, if we have either good or bad phenomena where someone's come in and they've performed a religious ritual, people have witnessed it or they know it's going to happen, and then activity stops, I think there's certainly very much a sort of placebo effect, where it's not so much an internal effect, only on our perceptions and how we're then perceiving their world. Unlike when we take a placebo in terms of a drug and we think it's having this internal effect, and we can see, your rash on your hand starts to go away and all sorts. But is that because of the power of positive thinking and what placebo can do? But I think certainly in cases I've heard of exorcisms around the house, people hearing bangs and raps and taps, which could just be the wood expanding and contracting, the central heating system, which they've interpreted as footsteps upstairs, and they'd heard that someone once lived there and it was haunted, they'd had claims, that they're going down that level of interpretation. But because someone in some form of authority, seemingly knowing what they're doing with that kind of activity, comes in and says, I'm going to do this, it works for other people, this is what we do, here's the process, here's the method, here's the ritual, this is what we do, they've seen it, that person has been very serious about it, whether it be psychologist or clergyman, they've gone in and they've done something, they've offered advice, they've gone in and seriously listened to the person, they said, right, it won't happen anymore. And so those bangs and raps and taps may still be occurring, but not interpreted or even noticed anymore in the way they had been done before. So people are very much having a paranormal experience because of their interpretation, and then because they've gone through a process, they don't notice it anymore. There's a filtration process going on internally because of the ritual they've been involved in.
So to that extent, you're willing to say it worked, but not necessarily for the reasons that the person coming in says it worked.
I think religious rituals can work, but not via anomalous means. They're not an anomalous process. Right. Someone has seen a ritual that's a human experience you can get involved in, and you can come away with some sort of new feeling, new experience, and a sort of enlightenment from having it. But it's because you've witnessed something that's not a daily occurrence, seeing one of these rituals. We could turn to any anthropological, take on this, looking at shamanic rituals and, either being music and ritualistic drumming or taking psychedelic reactants or burning something on a fire. You get engrossed in it. I love going to watch religious rituals. I go to, particularly there's a church locally, and every time they've got an event going on, I always go to midnight mass and stuff. And I'm not a religious person in the slightest, but I love watching and getting involved and seeing it happen. And I do feel good for watching it and being there. I like getting involved. So I can understand why other people get something out of an exorcism or other things.
Matt, what do you think of that interpretation of what's happening in an exorcism or some kind of religious ceremony to purify a house or a building and so on?
I think there is a heck of a lot that actually is going on there, that if there isn't a spiritual element to it, but it has been interpreted as a spiritual thing, then yes, the pastoral thing to do is to say, well, okay, what is going to work for this person to bring peace and healing and wholeness to the situation? Because that's what I, as a Christian, am supposed to do. If there is something that is spiritual, and this is where, as the Christian, I believe that there is a spiritual realm that is populated, then I would say that, well, I mean, I would say, have a look at Johann Blumhardt, a 19th century Lutheran pastor, who, when he was dealing with a particular case with Gottlieb Inditus, one of his parishioners, he ended up doing an exorcism that, when he was he said, okay, Lord, I want to make sure that this particular thing that I'm speaking to is, just stop me from wanting to know too much. Just let me know enough to be able to keep going with this particular process. And he basically ended up speaking and testing the spirits, which is what we're told to do in Scripture, test the spirits, which if something presents itself to us and we have to listen to what's been said and test it out. And he basically said that there was a woman, that he recognised as one of his old parishioners that had died. And he said, well, why are you still doing this? And she said, well, I've got unconfessed sin. I killed two of my children and they're buried in the field nearby. And he's like, oh, okay. You can't stay inside this person. I know what I'll do. I will send you to my church. So he actually sends the spirit of this dead woman to his church to actually listen to what's going on. This brought some relief to Gottlieb Inditus. And the process of doing his exorcism, and it took a while because there were several, over 1,000, he said, claimed inside this person. It took a while, and there were all sorts of phenomena that were going on around. Now, again, you have to kind of say, well, how much of this was going on that was just being produced by other people to try and stir stuff up? But the fruit of it was peace within her. It was peace within his family. And actually, it produced an awakening within the whole of his parish area, where people were suddenly saying, well, actually, I need to go to confession. And the whole place bloomed in terms of its relationships between people. People were just generally a lot nicer to each other. And, that was an awakening that came about.
Okay, so, does your sort of, Occam's razor approach mean that you always sort of want to come back to a kind of psychological reason for this? And I've heard similar accounts to Matt's of people who, have had some kind of what, on the surface, most, I'm sure, psychologists would put down to some kind of psychological issue, multiple personalities and so on. Where they went to many, many specialists, but eventually it was only some kind of rite of exorcism, perhaps by a Catholic priest or whatever, that suddenly, allowed them to experience peace and so on. But even in those sort of more extreme cases than just someone coming in and the radiator knocks turn out, to go away or whatever, would you always say you would prefer, let's say, to find a psychological reason rather than going to a supernatural reason, frankly.
Depends what I'm doing it for. You know, if someone suffered a loss and they're having after-death communication experiences, which we're studying a lot at the moment at the university, we're doing a large-scale survey at the moment. It's out in Dutch and German. Excuse me, we'd already done English, French and Spanish. Over 1,000 respondents. But the point of that is looking at the impact of these experiences on people. So we've published in the British Journal of Psychiatry Open. But you'll find these in parapsychology journals where you're looking for either conventional explanations for the experience or the psi aspect of them. You know, the apparitions delivered a message the person shouldn't know about, like we discussed earlier on. There's multiple witnesses. Or they've happened in a crisis instance where someone doesn't know that a family member or friend is under threat or dying, and they see an apparition at that very moment. It's only after the death that they find out that person has died. And so, you know, I could be looking for conventional explanations for a case, but often when I'm dealing with people and their experiences one-to-one, and they've gained something from it, either some sort of enlightenment or it's got something linked to bereavement, I cannot work in that capacity as a parapsychologist and take the experience away from them where I'm trying to see, is it a good case? Most of the time, there's a lot of conventional explanation to it, or it's just purely subjective, it seems to be. And I could tell them that and say, this is how science would view it, but then I've stolen something that's very precious from them. I've got no right or reason to do that. There's a lot of misperception in the media when we get a lot of popular TV scientists, and or they might be self-professed skeptics, and they say, you know, mediumship is wrong and it's only ever done people damage. Well, there's only, you know, less than a dozen in the last 10 years or so serious studies on mediumship and the health implications of people that go to them. And the idea that they cause damage only or it's deceptive is absolute nonsense. If you want to purely go down the clinical route, they're very beneficial as an alternative form of counselling where someone doesn't want to go and see a counselling psychologist. They don't want to see a psychotherapist. They don't want to see their GP. They fear being told they've got some form of psychosis if they're dreaming of the dead or they feel their presence in the room from time to time. However, with the medium who can relate to these experiences, whether they're actually doing what they claim they're doing or not, they'll speak to them on a sympathetic level. They can relate to other people having told them their experiences, and the medium claims they have them all the time. So they find it in a more comforting therapeutic setting. They will say, this is good for you. They're visiting. It helps. It heals.
And on that level, you're treating the medium in the same capacity as you would view a Christian priest. You know, they're potentially offering some kind of solace that may help this person. You know, whether or not you believe that there's something really supernatural going on behind it, it's going to bring them to some place of health.
That is not to say, though, that if we found that a particular medium is known or has been caught out for false practice, that they won't get outed. They will. Mm. And the same happens in parapsychology for researchers that have been caught fiddling with their data and cheating. They've been named and shamed in journals. So a medium may keep very low key and just give readings that aren't overly fantastic, but at the same time there's not much to challenge there. If they're making big claims and want to be tested, they can be put to the test, and there they're walking on thin ice as to whether they succeed or they can't perform when being tested with controls in place. But if they're doing something fraudulently, if they get caught out in the dark, if cameras are set up and you see that, people even in recent times, big names, have been named and shamed for what they're doing.
I would say that actually it's quite interesting that spiritualism rose in popularity straight after World War I and World War II because the church wasn't providing a pastorally sensitive approach to these people's experiences after death communications. And so rather than going to the priest, and the priest was just sort of like dismissing it and saying, oh, it's all in your mind, go and see the psychologist or the psychiatrist. They were actually saying, no, I saw my dead son, I saw my dead father, they told me something. And the reality of what they were experiencing was taken away by the priest, but they actually found validation, sadly, in the spiritualist church. And I think the spiritualist church is one of the unpaid debts of the church.
Well, look, I want to open this up a bit in the final segment of the show, perhaps to find out a bit from you, Matt, what your view is of mediums and that sort of thing, why you think the biblical worldview is a better way of understanding the spiritual realm and engaging it than a medium, say, approach, or even Cal's approach as someone more committed to a kind of finding naturalistic explanations for these phenomena. So we'll be back again after a short moment's break, and we're talking about the paranormal, exorcism, deliverance, that kind of stuff on the show today. My guests are Matt Arnold and Cal Cooper. ¶¶
listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to this week's edition of the show, continuing to talk about ghosts, exorcism, paranormal in just a moment's time. If you can stick around this evening here on Premier Christian Radio, on the profile, Jack Graham, pastor of Prestonwood, the megachurch in Texas, will be talking to Sam Hales about his life and faith and what it's like to be a megachurch pastor. He's also featured in the January edition of Premier Christianity magazine. Next week here on Unbelievable, I wonder, have you seen ChatGPT? It's the new AI software everyone is talking about. It can seem to produce unique articles, scripts, sermons, computer code, anything you want at the drop of a hat. It's nothing short of magical, actually. But what do these advances mean for society? Well, physician and researcher Dr. John Wyatt joined me and Ruth Jackson just this last week for a show discussing things like ChatGPT, the advance of AI and robotics, and how Christians should respond faithfully in a technologically confusing world. We'll be airing that show next week, and you can hear the questions our audience had for John as well. By the way, just another reminder, our next live show that you can be with us for is Sexuality, Gender and Identity. We'll be debating that. Andrew Bunt and Charlie Bell, two same-sex attracted Christians on different sides of this debate, join me on Tuesday, the 7th of February. You can book now to be part of that live show at unbelievable.live. Let's go to the final part of this week's discussion. Welcome back. We're talking about paranormal hauntings and exorcism on the show today. My guest, Matt Arnold, a Christian minister and editor of the Christian Parapsychologist Journal, joins me along with Dr. Callum Cooper, who's a psychologist, science promoter, teaching at the University of Northampton. I'll leave links to both of them with today's show, but if you want to go straight to Matt's website, it's ghostschoolsandgod.co.uk, and Cal can be found at callumecooper.com. Perhaps you want to, you know, study with Cal. Perhaps you want to find out more about Matt's work. Go to those links to find out more. Just to kind of open up a fairly big question at this point, Matt, for you, which is, you know, hearing what Cal had to say there about the fact that for him, you know, yes, if a medium provides some kind of solace to someone who's experiencing something and a Christian priest does, well, you know, who's he to say that that's wrong? If it works, it works, even if he has a different understanding of what's going on behind it. What's your approach to that, Matt? Why do you believe Christianity is a better explanation of what's happening in the spiritual realm and a better way of engaging that reality than the medium, perhaps better even than Cal's sort of commitment to a kind of naturalistic explanations?
Well, I as a Christian, I'm going to be kind of a little bit biased towards the Christian perspective on things. I would say that spiritualism has had a very ragged history, as has the church in places. And so where the church has often tried to duck the question of what exists within the afterlife, the spiritualist church has run headlong into it. And I think you have to urge caution with this. What is the objective that you're trying to do with this? Are you trying to bring peace and healing and wholeness to a person? Or are you just trying to do effectively a stage show for people? And if it's a stage show, entertainment type thing, I find that very distasteful. That's why I don't like things like ghost hunt, because the idea that if these are souls of the deceased, then why are we hunting them? You know, it just doesn't make sense. So in terms of trying to, I think what the church needs to do is to unpack its ideas that it originally had about the afterlife, so that it can address these unpaid bills of the church that are things like the spiritualist movement or the New Age movement, where people are wanting experiential stuff of the afterlife. And I think we have to listen carefully to the experiences that Christians have been having about this as well and say, you know, these aren't all demons, whatever demon meant, because that means something very different in different parts of the Bible anyway. So when you come to things like mediums, even, when we see the word in the King James, it's witch, which has its own baggage. When you see later editions, translations, it becomes medium, which again has its own associations with the spiritualist church, and you know, on the telly, psychic mediums. And I think that what we need to do is say, well, what was the original? And the original seems to be, as Irving Finkel, who's written a book called The First Ghosts, suggests, it's the mistress of the ghost, the mistress of the Ove. And that was a very different thing to mediumship today. And I think if we labelled what somebody's psychical gift is of seeing, clairaudience, clairvoyance, and we labelled that as, say, a spiritual gift in the church, then people would go, oh, yeah, that's okay. If somebody... Mm. And there are deliverance ministers that will take somebody who is a churchgoer, who's a committed Christian, who can see things that are, you know, that are off limits to us. And as a result of that, they can say, well, we can bring healing and wholeness to this place. So I think for me, it's about where is whatever's going on, what is the focus and the objective of it. Things like Samuel, if you read in, I think it's 1 Samuel chapter 9 and 10, Samuel is initially introduced as a seer, and Saul loses some, I think it's horses or donkeys or something, and they say, well, let's go up and see this seer that happens to be Samuel, and then eventually he becomes a prophet. So I think it's about how we take that gift that we've given and focus it. Is it for other ends, our own ego trip, or is it for God's glory?
So are you essentially, what I'm hearing, I think, Matt, from you, is that these kind of spiritual gifts, let's say, mm-hmm. just do exist mm-hmm. among people. There's people who are sensitive to these sorts of things, perhaps have it, but when they, I don't know, in a Christian context, come under the lordship of Christ, let's say, mm-hmm. that they get expressed properly in that instance, and they may be more kind of, it's more of a Wild West if people are just kind of using them however they see fit outside of that?
My understanding would be that everybody has gifts of some sort or another at some point in their time that God gives us. And from that, we need to say, well, how can I use this more appropriately to further the kingdom of God, to bring that healing and wholeness to people and place that is experiencing either the unquiet dead or something non-human that is particularly nasty.
Which is why presumably you would not advise people to go to the medium or the Ouija board or whatever in order to kind of try and find that sort of...
My advice would be no, but find a Christian who can listen, which is kind of why the Church's Fellowship for Psychical and Spiritual Studies exists, because we are there with specifically Christian remit and a framework, a biblical understanding of these things, to be able to try and help people who've had these experiences where their ministers are just saying, oh, this is just demonic, ignore it, or the gift that you've got you need to just repent of and abandon. And it's actually, maybe God's given you a gift for a reason. It depends on how you get that gift as well, but that's another kettle of fish.
What do you make of all this, Cal, from your perspective?
You just made me think of, in that last bit there, a friend and colleague of mine that I've sadly never got to meet in person except at his own funeral, but a guy called William Dewi Rees, Dewi being the Welsh name for David, and he went by Dewi or David. And he was a Christian and regular church attendee, but he was a general practitioner. That was how he initially became doctor, but he later went on and did an MD thesis by research. And he wanted to do it at King's College under the guise of medicine. But his ideas on looking at the negative side of bereavement, the outcomes of it, loneliness and not wanting to socialise either, and lack of sleep, lack of appetite, all the negatives that you could describe from separation anxiety. But they led him through psychiatry to do it. And so he became more attached to psychiatry. He did this thesis and discovered during these times people would report sense of presence phenomena a lot more. But then he'd go back to his church and contribute to the church newspaper about it. And then more people, attendees, would come out and say, I had this experience after my wife or my husband died, or when my daughter died, or so-and-so has experienced this. And he was starting to gather more accounts, which he wrote in his final book, or one of his final books, 2010, Pointers to Eternity. But his initial paper on his medical doctorate thesis, 1971, Hallucinations of Widowhood, it was published in the British Medical Journal. It caused a massive turning in parapsychology and medical science to acknowledge these experiences and not dismiss them when you go to see your general practitioner, as this research bled out more and was being recited more. And it was because of people like Dewi that now we have sections of psychiatric associations, especially in the UK, where when you look to psychiatry, one of its branches is dealing with spiritual experiences that include these as well and being sympathetic towards them. You also have it with the British Psychological Society. You at least have one section that deals with exceptional experiences and consciousness studies, and another section that deals with transpersonal psychology. And so when you go to these major disciplines dealing with human behaviour, mental health, we find that they have subsections of specialists now dealing with it. And it's thanks to people like Dewey that had a nice overlap between science, medical practice, and his own Christian beliefs as well and practice, that he'd read on all these different areas and how they can all marry up together. I always find it annoying when I get to, I don't know, a house party or a dinner thing or something like that, and someone says, science has no place in religion, religion has no place in science. I think religion has a really unique way in all the texts of showing some early documentation and trying to understand a human experience, sometimes through a story or through an interpretation of experience, where even though maybe the science isn't established then, it's still one human's retelling of another person's story or directly of a story, trying to make sense of it. And if they can't, it's encapsulated within the religious practice as well. And this is what it means to me in my religious perspective or through a spiritual lens. And yet, because of things like parapsychology, you can take a number of religious texts, strip away the interpretation and still find, look, this is universal. Every culture is experiencing this that is human. You know, this is a widely seen human phenomena as far back as we can go. It's just been put under a capsule of whatever religions and cultural practices they may be. And so you can learn so much by sometimes turning to a culture and looking at its experiences and beliefs and how it deals with certain things, to then marry it back to psychology and psychiatry. We even have physics playing a hand in as well, that's got to listen to the psychologists and how the psychologists are talking to the theologians as well. So everything seems to interconnect. A great thing that the Parapsychology Foundation did since 1951 was it used to hold an annual conference, an international conference, and it'd always be on a theme of parapsychology and parapsychology and education, parapsychology and philosophy. It did several on theology. And J.B. Ryan, who was the turning point for parapsychology, he really kind of established parapsychology in the university in 1920, in the 1920s at Duke University, found a good repeated method for testing ESP in the labs, adding controls, trying to bring parapsychology into the light of science, and he did. He got the Parapsychological Association established. He got it recognised by the American Association for the Advancement of Science by 1969. It's still an affiliate of that, so it's recognised as a science. But his initial way into life, his family wanted him to be a Christian minister. And he got into his later schooling, got into biology. His PhD was in botany. So was his wife's, Louisa Ryan. They both had a PhD in botany. And they turned to psychology. And so he still had this side interest in theology and how it could contribute. What was going to be his very last address when they made him, just before his death, president of the British Society for Psychical Research, his address was going to be on parapsychology and religion. And he didn't quite get to finish it. He'd written on it before, but at the very end of his life, he'd turned back to it, saying we could learn a lot about survival by, again, marrying science with religion. And so some of these really good scientists, I think, have an appreciation of listen to everyone, read as much as you can, consider all perspectives, but put healthy scepticism in there as well. So that's, I suppose, the final message. Sure. I give to him.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, why don't we turn to a final message from both of you on that? Because, Matt, in the end, if you were kind of speaking to another skeptic, you know, someone perhaps who doesn't share your Christian worldview, let's say, do you think the evidence is there, if you just look at the research that both you and Cal have, you know, both looked at, that there's something beyond just the purely natural world, beyond just the laws of nature, the physics of the world, that there is some kind of a realm that, you know, that manifests itself ultimately? Is that just where the evidence points to for you, Matt?
I think we're at a stage where we were at the time of Galileo, where some of the scientists were saying, oh no, the Earth's at the centre of the solar system, and Galileo and Kepler and the others were saying, no, I think the sun is at the centre of the solar system. And the church was saying, we think it's the Earth that's at the centre, and we're going to go with the scientists at the time. I think with things like near-death experiences, the veridical stuff that's coming through, the evidential stuff that is corroborated by other people as well, some of the out-of-body experience things that have been happening, that have been reported, multiple out-of-body experiences, after-death communications, all of these things. These are data that we should not be frightened of. These are data, and there's, you know, you can take one piece of data and it's like a twig, you can snap it easily. But if you take all of the data and you put it into a bundle, it is much more difficult to break that bundle, and the evidence sort of from all over the place seems to suggest that there is more to this life than simply the physicalist approach.
Interesting. Cal, presumably you haven't got to the point where the data has convinced you that it could be attributed ultimately to something more than ultimately physical explanations, if that makes sense.
No, I think I have. I mean, I'm a scientist and I'm data-driven, and so I'll go on what the data's saying. And there's been plenty of recent papers summarising meta-analyses, which are, take one particular topic, say healing or telepathy, and look at all studies that adopted a similar method over time. We've done many replications. What do they say overall? All the failures, all the successes, how good is its effect rate and how significant is it? That's what it gives you ultimately. Also gives you an interesting number that tells you if this isn't true, if there's a load of studies that never saw the light of publication, how many would there have to be hidden away for this to, you know, not be true? And sometimes it's into the hundreds. Parapsychology has so very little funding and person power that, you know, people have either done this in their retirement or as a hobby. I'm very fortunate that I am a paid lecturer and this is part of my profession, but it's very few. But still, to do one study can sometimes take 12 months or more to do one small study on just a couple of £1,000, which actually isn't very much for a social science study. Some people's funding goes into the hundreds of thousands. And yet we've done these. You can't afford to not publish a study that doesn't find anything. We publish everything. And it's always been our remit to do so. And Etzel Cardenia did a paper for American Psychologists, which is the flagship journal for psychology in America. It's big. And he published a summary of all these parapsychological studies, essentially just saying, you know, look, it's significant overall the board. It's good. It's good. It's significant. And it's comparable to a lot of other psychology. In some cases, it's better. Professor Caroline Watt had said that at the University of Edinburgh. And many, many years before, Gertrude Schmeidler commented on all the Rhine studies with the Zener cards and said, look, as a starting step, these forced choice studies of five different card symbols over and over again, and how well can people guess? People are going above what chance expects, some people. And with those people, that they're doing it again and again, it's a good effect. If you were to challenge these studies, you cannot challenge them on statistical grounds. They brought in statisticians to check them. And so something in the lab studies, the controlled studies, is certainly going on that defies our current understanding of psychology. It's suggesting very much the very phenomena that we're looking into, but the next step is working more alongside neuroscience to really understand during these studies, when someone is tested, what is going on in the brain as this happens. And baby steps, we're right at the beginning of this. We've done bits, but there's just not enough people, not enough funding.
Well, it's very refreshing to hear such an open mind from someone, because as I alluded to at the very beginning, often the phrase skeptic can automatically mean I am always going to debunk everything that doesn't sound like it's just a completely naturalistic explanation for something. And it's great to hear, Cal, that you're sort of saying, no, I'm open to the evidence. And if it's, you know, if we need to rethink, you know, the way we understand science or, you know, the nature of human reasoning or whatever, then we need to go there.
I think the same needs to go with from a church perspective, from a Christian perspective. We've got the same data. We shouldn't be afraid to challenge some of our preconceived theological ideas, just like we did with the sky didn't fall down when we decided that the sun was at the centre of the universe. At the centre of the solar system for Christianity. So I don't think the sky should fall down if suddenly we find that the afterlife is more active. And we don't, when we die, go billions of light years away, but actually I think heaven and Hades, the underworld, as it were, are closer dimensionally than we actually realise.
Interesting. Cal, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I mean, if anyone has that kind of perspective, that closed down one that you mentioned, that's more going into a territory where you're actually dealing with either a cynic or a dogmatic sceptic, where they're calling themselves sceptic as though they want to afford themselves that idea that they're an open-minded person, because who will want to label themselves as a closed-down person who's not willing to consider anything? And this is my opinion. But actually, if we've got a label on things, they're acting cynically, but they don't want that label because it's insulting and it suggests that they're not thinking clearly. But sometimes they are, because you've shook up their worldview if it doesn't sit with what they've been taught, how they've been told about science or anything else. And so we've now got, we've for a long time studied the psychology of paranormal belief. We're spending more time now looking at the psychology of what people believe to be their own scepticism. But where is it sitting on the scale of, well, you know, how good a sceptic are you? Are you just challenging what you know about your own profession? Or are you going beyond that? Or are you just closing everything down every time someone talks to you about something new you know nothing about? Rupert Sheldrake said something quite interesting at the end of a debate he had with a philosopher and someone else. And he shut it down and he got a round of applause, which I thought was really nice. And he said, look, what I really don't understand is why people that know nothing about something feel the need so badly to, you know, denounce something that they have to form little groups together with people and go about denouncing it. Some of these sceptic organisations. He said, I don't go around denouncing astrophysics or physical chemistry. You know, why would I do that? He is a biologist, sits in the realm of biology and tries to understand things from that perspective and acts sceptically, regardless of his religious beliefs and regardless of what he might think ultimately of the phenomena. He has to work under the remit of scientific methods. Otherwise, his papers will never get put through peer review. Mm. It has to be recognised science, has to be recognised method. And one more point, there was you talked about, it was relevant to what you just mentioned about worldviews again, but it was Jim Allcott, who, I think it was Matt, what you just said about, the worlds that we live in. Jim Allcott had said at the start of one of his books, he's a renowned sceptic of parapsychology and in sceptic associations, but he'd said in his book that's sort of very much anti-sci, but it said, and Chris quotes this, Chris Rowe, imagine a world that we could live in. Imagine a world where sci did exist, where psychic phenomena did exist. What would that be like? It would be like this. It's this world. It would be exactly the same. Yep. Psi phenomena can be often very boring and mundane and unnoticeable unless you're actively looking for it. You know what it looks like, how it operates. It's not predicting the lottery numbers every day. It's not turning to a medium and saying, my granddad died a number of years ago. His name is Bill. Can you give me a message from me? Da, 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 da. And they give you absolutely every single bit of information in perfect clarity. Mediums don't tend to operate like that. It's dribs and drabs and some specific information. People have a vague idea of something before it's happened and then they realise how it ties together. It's not pitch perfect like in the films. It seems to occur. The only way you can seem to harness it is through statistical evidence in the labs. You know, I've blocked off every means of you doing any kind of cheating or knowing what the target is, and sometimes we even make the target a future outcome. So no one has access to it until after the study's done. And yet, with these controls, we are getting studies where they're statistically significant. Mm. So, you know, we're harnessing something, but it's such a subtle effect.
Yeah. Would love to get you both on maybe for a future show to talk about, you know, because we hardly opened up that aspect of it, you know, the lab-controlled type, you know, types of experiments that have been going on. And I know that Rupert Sheldrake has been, you know, conducting research along those lines and others. So there's a whole other world of, you know, interesting stuff to open up there. But it's been a fascinating conversation today. Thank you again both for coming on. Again, just a reminder, if you want more from Matt, ghostschoolsandgod.co.uk. Cal is at callumecooper.com. I'll make sure the links are with today's show. But for now, Matt and Cal, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Look forward to hearing what you made of this. You can email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Do feel free to leave your thoughts as well on our social media at unbelievablefe for our Twitter account. Also facebook.com/premierunbelievable if you want to get hold of us on Facebook. There's lots of ways to get in touch, and I'll be bringing some of your feedback to recent editions of the show in just a mo. If you enjoy Unbelievable, you'll probably love some of the other podcasts we put out from Premier Unbelievable, our umbrella apologetics and theology department. Ask NT Wright Anything, of course, another popular podcast. The latest is on whether women should lead in church and why does 1 Timothy tell women to be silent? NT Wright responding to those sorts of questions. On Matters of Life and Death, featuring John Wyatt and Tim, Martin Rees, number 3. This is a re-airing of that discussion that John Wyatt had with Lord Martin Rees on preemptive science fiction, the morality-reality gap, adventurers on Mars, and and the mind of the creator is what they get into. Over on the C.S. Lewis podcast, Ruth Jackson has started a major new series with Alistair McGrath, digging deep into the life of C.S. Lewis. On the last show there, we're looking at C.S. Lewis's Irish childhood. And on Unapologetic, also with Ruth Jackson, she's speaking to Trevin Wax. Can orthodoxy be thrilling? So those are just some of the podcasts just from the past week that you can get hold of. PremierUnbelievable.com to see them all, or just search them up on your podcast software. We also publish articles too. Two of the popular ones from the past week have been reflecting on that discussion between Michael Gunger and Evan Wickham that we aired last year. Is the Western Church's problem that it's too self-centered? Asked Heather Tomlinson as she reflected on that conversation between Evan and Gunger. Well, Michael Gunger has also written a response piece asking, well, is it arrogant to disagree, Heather? So if you want to look at both of those pieces, do again go to premierunbelievable.com, click on articles, and you'll see what's there. And thanks to everyone who gets in touch with the show each week in one form or another. A Danish debater tweeted me this past week or two saying that he decided to download and listen to my audiobook, Unbelievable, Why After Talking With Atheists for 10 Years, I'm Still a Christian. Danish debater himself being an atheist. I'm always interested in hearing how atheists respond to that book. And he wrote quite a long review over on Twitter. And it was very kind, generous, also obviously had some criticisms in it. But I love it when I hear about people doing that. So thank you very much, Danish debater. Joe Wild gets in touch on email to say, I'm an 18-year-old from Down Under in Australia, from a relatively small country town called Bendigo. I've been an avid listener of Unbelievable ever since my mum first sent me an episode with Sean McDowell and a former Christian artist back in 2020. I suspect that must have been John Steingard, is the episode you're referring to there, Joe. Since then, I've rarely missed an episode, often go back and listen to some of the back catalogue. Your shows, alongside others like William Lane Craig, John Lennox, and online debates, ignited a passion for apologetics and contemporary Christian ideas, which I still have today. Now, it's quite apparent I am a Christian myself, yet I'm rather sceptical person. I like to question everything, especially the nitty-gritty aspects of Christianity. In essence, I'd like to be certain of my faith and not just rest my belief on a feeling I had in church. But as I'm sure everyone understands, certainty is an almost unattainable and perhaps misguided wish. Nonetheless, as your recent guest Tim Keller noted, it's the accumulation of the evidence for God that I actually rest my faith on. So I hope this message finds you well, encourages you as you encourage me and my mother daily as we listen to Unbelievable. So thank you very much. It's lovely to hear from fresh show listeners, Joe, especially from all the way on the other side of the world, to me at least, in Australia. God bless you. Thanks to all those as well who've been getting in touch regarding last week's show with Tim Keller, where we aired that live listener Q&A. Jenny tweeted, listening to this was a superb way to start my day, plodding slowly around a soggy Letchworth, feeling the mince pies on my first post-Christmas run. So grateful, though, for Tim Keller's wisdom. Well worth an hour of your time. Thank you. Rosemary also enjoyed it. Said, watched this yesterday. Hugely recommended. It is wisdom distilled. Great questions, too. And James says, the timing of having Tim Keller on the show and my personal struggles with forgiving felt very providential. I'm finding it difficult forgiving a person once close to me, and I keep playing the internal recordings. I finally come to the conclusion to seek Christian counselling to finally mute the playback. Thank you for having Tim Keller on. It's humbling to hear that the show has helped you in that way, James, and all the best for you as you go on that journey. Lots of response as well to the Christmas show we put out. Martin Shaw and Nico Tarquinio, both talking about conversion, one a more intellectual conversion, the other a more sort of supernatural, visionary conversion in the case of Martin Shaw. A lot of people responding, actually, to Martin Shaw's story, who I think a lot of people hadn't come across before, but I think is becoming more well known. So, for instance, Tom Trees says, I wanted to let you know I really enjoyed the conversation you had with mythologist Martin Shaw. Hadn't heard of him before, but now we'll look him up. It just so happens that my Christmas Eve sermon at St. James's Episcopal Church focused on C.S. Lewis's essay, Myth Became Fact. Seemed like an uncanny confirmation. Have a happy new year. Thank you, Tom. You're out in Portland, I believe. And you met me at the Unbelievable Conference there in 2018. Good to hear from you. Over on YouTube, lots of love for this show. Brian says, no matter how many questions I have, the absurdities, the paradoxes, the seeming contradictions, the historical questions, the end time questions, the experiential frustrations, I am always confronted with this fact. Nobody is, has been, or will be as perfect and as beautiful as Jesus Christ to me. I can't escape the fact that through the absurdities of my experience that I know that God loves me, that he is a person and not some inanimate force, that truth is personal, and that it'll be all right in the end, even though we might have everything else screaming at us in full blast that we're living in a terrible tragedy. There are far better things waiting for us than any we have left behind. We are loved. Thank you, Jesus. Noradian comments, same journey here as Martin Shaw, but I come from a Sufi background with Aramaic roots, but the intensity really ramped up for me via the visionaries of Garabandal, yep, Divine Mother, Archangel Michael, and an infant Christ. From addressing God as the beloved to being beloved, great to hear this man's elaborate revelation. What an interesting journey you've had. Ron says, as a hospital chaplain since 1979, I've never heard anything quite so remarkable. My uncle, in 1949, founded of the Back to the Bible broadcast, would have envied the day he had an interview like this. A superb interview. And Autumn says, I've found people over the last 3 years, Rod Dreher, Paul Kingsnorth and others, that I've followed because I love what they do, only to find out later that they've become a Christian. Well, this has done more than anything else to solidify my own reversion and journey. I'm so thrilled to listen to Martin melding the mystical and mythical with the truth and beauty of Christ's story and living being. Hallelujah. Christ is risen. Thanks for a great chat. Finally, Anthony says, a wonderful interview. As someone whose conversion to Christianity took place through a momentary visionary experience of Christ, I resonate when I hear other testimonies like this one. It is a radical reminder of the God who is there and who breaks through even into the most hard or apathetic of hearts. Well, if you want to hear or watch back the interview with Martin Shaw that those people are referencing, do go and check out the Christmas edition of the show, or check us out on YouTube as well. Well, that's all we've time for in terms of feedback. Thanks to everyone who's been in touch. Again, if you want to get in touch yourself, you can email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Just a reminder that our next live show, Tuesday the 7th of February, is on sexuality, gender and identity. I'll be joined by Andrew Bunt and Charlie Bell. You can book in now at unbelievable.live. For now, let me tell you what's coming up next time. A lot of people have been talking about this new AI software platform, ChatGPT. Seems to be able to produce at the drop of a hat unique articles, essays, scripts, sermons, computer code, whatever you want. It feels magical, and we're sort of entering the age of sci-fi. But what do these advances mean for society? Physician and researcher Dr. John Wyatt joined myself and Ruth Jackson just this past week. We'll be putting out the discussion we have with him on living faithfully in a technologically confusing world and all the questions we had in from our audience too. For now, thanks for being with us, and see you next time.